understanding of sin as a kind of drifted away, then for us we'll have to redefine it in our own thinking. Have Luke 15 open. Yes, and if you look at verse 28, he says this: the older brother became angry and refused to go in, so his father went out and pleaded with him. So at the end of the parable, the younger son, the obvious sinner, celebrates with his father. But the parable ends with the older son refusing to join in his father's celebration. The obvious sinner has been forgiven and accepted. The good boy is excluded. There's clearly something wrong at a much deeper level than you can see from the day-to-day behavior of the two sons. We need to think about sin and what it really means. Let's just pray. Our Father, we know, because we're well taught, that sin is the real problem with this world. It's the real problem with us. It's the thing that separates us, mankind, from you. Father, teach us more clearly the very nature of sin as we look at aspects of this parable today this morning. We ask this so that we would appreciate all the more what you have done for us in Christ. Amen. So here's a question. Is there such a thing as an acceptable sin? Now, if I was to ask you individually and go around the room, I know the answer I'd get. The answer would be no, because we are all very good evangelicals. But is this what we really, practically think? Or what we live by from hour to hour? I mean, when we look at ourselves, do we really see pride and lust in the same light? Or maybe we could ask ourselves the question, are some sins worse than others? And again, we could give a good biblical answer and say, no, all sin is sin. But obviously the punishment is fit for crime. Yeah. That's a good biblical answer, very correct. But speeding, white lies, gossip, but they even feel like sin. Can they be in the same category as, well, you know, the really bad stuff? We can give good theoretical answers to these questions about sin, but in practice, we tend to discriminate in ways which don't necessarily tie up with our good theological answers. Perhaps we simply need a better definition of sin. So how would you define sin? How would you define sin? Again, if I went around the room, which I won't, I would expect to hear some good evangelical biblical answers. For example, I might hear, sin is something in every human heart that results in us doing wrong things. That's quite a good answer. That's the answer, that's the definition that I've felt we use with children when we want to explain what sin is. Yeah, it's a good enough answer. But does it really go deep enough in defining what sin actually is? Now, to help us, I'd like to introduce you to two people to help us think about the nature of a sin. I'm going to call them Frieda and Frederick. I don't think we've got any Frieda and Frederick, and if we have, no offense to them. Frederick is a regular churchgoer. He's respected by people who know him. He's actually a very nice chap. He works for a family business. He's hardworking and very, very much. He's looking forward to taking over from his dad when the time comes, and he believes that the moral standards of the Bible are important both for himself and for the nation. So there you are, that's a good picture. Frieda considers herself, on the other hand, to be a free spirit. She loves the idea of freedom. Friedman is an ardent supporter of human rights and equal rights issues. She's particularly motivated by the conviction that each individual has the right to choose for themselves. So she actively promotes same-sex marriage, the right to choose the gender in which you feel most comfortable. She feels very strongly that a woman has the right to decide what she does with her body, and that abortion is therefore a right, which should be the decision of the woman. Frieda feels that life is a journey of self-discovery, and is there to be enjoyed to the full. She's experimented for a while with a homosexual relationship, and she likes the idea of remaining fluid. Suppose Frederick and Frieda met. Frieda considers people like Frederick to be the real problem in the world. People who try and impose outdated and unsophisticated dogma on the rest of society. If she met Frederick, she would feel angry with him, but also in a maybe slightly sarcastic way, sorry for him as well. She would see him as Victorian, bigoted, and repressive, holding back people from real fulfillment in life. And she might just say that he really wants to get out there. On the other hand, Frederick sees Frieda as the cause of the problems that are undermining society. The ideals that she champions and lives by are fundamentally wicked. And I'm not going to disagree with them. And she and the people like her are ruining themselves, but are headed to a godless eternity. But more importantly, they are undermining the very moral fabric of society. Now, I guess that you have already worked out, if you read the book, you'll have certainly worked out, that Frieda and Frederick are based on the two brothers in the parable. Jesus has told an amazingly crafted story, which illustrates two types of people. But not just two types of people, any two types of people, as we will consider, as we think about it a bit more, we'll see that really everyone fits into one type or the other. It is possible to straddle both, and we'll think about that a bit in a moment, but don't get a lot of thoughts about that. But to a significant extent, we are either one type or the other. Frederick, the older brother, is hardworking and will be taking over the family business when his father dies. He's morally upright, and we know from the parable that the family is religious. Frieda, the younger brother, wants to throw off the shackles of his household and upbringing and to experience all that the world has to offer. Traditional morality takes second place to self-discovery and enjoyment. The older son, like Frederick, follows the way of moral conformity. The younger son, like Frieda, follows the way of self-discovery. And just about everyone falls into one of those or the other. I mean, did you find yourself more drawn to Frieda or Frederick when I described them? If you were drawn to Frieda, then the rest of us can arrange some counselling for you. Evangelicals, of course, tend to be more like Frederick. Although secretly, they may well have very strong leanings towards the desire for self-discovery and instant gratification, but you wouldn't know it. That would be beneath the surface, away from public gaze. And as I said, it is possible to straddle both camps together. But Jesus in this parable presents us with two mindsets. And we can agree that Jesus has represented two types of people which we fairly readily recognize in ourselves and in other people. It's not difficult, is it, to think about our workplace, to think about someone that we know, think about someone in the news, and think, yeah, they're essentially in that camp or in that camp. Clearly, some will struggle both. But it does fit, doesn't it, with what we see around us. And I think ourselves, we know where we are after this. But here's the big issue that Jesus is confronting in this parable. Both of the brothers are lost. This isn't really the parable of the lost son, it's the parable of the two lost sons. Both of the brothers are invited into the father's feast. The younger brother accepts the invitation and is astounded at such undeserved love. But at the end of the parable, the older brother has not accepted the invitation, although the invitation is still open. The shocking truth for Jesus' listeners is that both brothers are sinful. More shocking still is that the overtly sinful brother is welcomed into the joy of his father. But the morally upright brother remains estranged from his father. On the basis of this parable, we might reasonably deduce that it is easier for someone overtly sinful to be saved than someone who is morally upright than Moses. Which brings us closer to the very heart of what sin is. What is it that makes both of these brothers so sinful, so separated from their father? Since this, both brothers want their father's blessing, they do not want their father. Both brothers want their father's blessing, but they do not want their father. The younger brother wants to shut his father out, to unshackle himself from his father's household, to do his own thing, unencumbered by traditional morality. The older brother wants to manipulate his father. He wants his father to act on his terms. He wants the just rewards for his hard work. Neither brother acts out of love for their father. Both of them have desires for their self-serving. Now, in case you think I've taken leave of the parable, let's just have a look at some key phrases about Jesus, the great storyteller, uses. Look at verse 12. Father, give me my share of the estate. This is an unthinkable request in the culture of the time, and in reality, it probably still is unthinkable. This will, of course, undermine the family business that the father has worked so hard to build up. And it will hurt his older brother, now working as part of a smaller business. And why does he make this request? Is it too going to some entrepreneurial development, some business plan, some idea to do something which will bring honour to the family name? Let's have a look at verse 13. Not long after that, the younger brother got together all he had and set off for a distant country where he squandered his wealth in wild living. The motivation of the younger brother was simple. He wanted to indulge himself. His aim was a life of self-gratification and anger consequences. And the father is so clearly a loving man. It's obvious from the end of the parable how loving he is towards his children. How could this son throw such love back in his father's face? Just because he wanted to be his own boss, with immediate effect, just because he wanted a good time at his father's expense. So to see that in the younger son is very easy. He didn't want his dad. He just wanted what his dad had to offer, the money. And what of the older brother? Guess what he's doing when the younger brother returns? Yes, of course, he's out in the fields working. He does. Look at verse 26 to 27. Verse 35 says, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. True to form, he didn't want to shirk his responsibilities or even leave his job for a minute. So rather than leave his work, he calls over a hired hand and says, you know, what's happening? Verse 28 to 30. The older brother became angry and refused to go in, so his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you, never disobeyed your orders. You never gave me even a young goat that I can celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you killed the fat calf. The father is loving, but the elder son is angry because of just the injustice of it. He has slaved for his father. He's never disobeyed his father. He sees his father's orders and does them. He deserves the estate and to be in good form when he takes it over, not frittered away on an unjustified celebration. He criticizes his father for not spoiling him too, or spoiling him. But of course, he conveniently forgets, chooses to forget, all that his father would have done to provide for him in his future over so many years. The older brother, morally upright, hardworking, hating his brother for his selfish and openly sinful behavior, hurt by the personal cost of himself, and to the honor of the family man. You know, I really don't think there can be anyone in this room who doesn't have some sympathy for the old one. And yet he is the one who does not accept the invitation to his father's marriage party. In this parable, the way of moral conformity is presented as the more dangerous of the two ways of thinking and living. A morally upright person who is not motivated by love for God and desire for God is just as lost as the overtly sinful younger brother. Jesus addressed this parable to Pharisees. They were morally upright, hardworking, hating selfish and openly sinful behavior, hurt by the dishonor that sinners brought to the people of God. They were all those things. But Bible history tells us that they were the most difficult to reach for the gospel. So it's right then, isn't it, that Jesus leaves the older brother outside of his father's joyful celebration. So looking at these two, how do we define sin? Or perhaps, how do we redefine sin if we were to do that? Sin is not acting out of love for God. Sin is not acting out of love for God. Neither brother acted out of love for their father. The younger openly turned his back on his father and went away to please himself with all the wealth that his father worked to provide for him. The older brother was also self-serving. His morality was his badge of honor. His hard work was slavery. His desire was that he should feel good about himself by his own standards. In reality, little to choose between them. Both are self-serving. Both want to decide for themselves how things should be. Neither love their father for who he was. Sin is not acting out of love for God. Or, to put it another way, sin is not keeping the first and greatest commandment. Let's turn back to Mark 12:29. Mark 12:29, 29 to 30. The most important commandment, answered Jesus, is this: Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. Sin is not keeping that command. Sin is not acting as love for God. And when it comes down to it, we look at those two brothers, and we look at Frederick and Frieda, and there's not a great deal of issues between them. They are both all acting for themselves. Self-serving, wanting to decide for themselves how things should be, not loving the Father for who he was, and acting on that love. Neither brother acted out of love for their father, so they were both lost to him. Now next week, we're going to be looking at the older brother in a bit more detail. And the main thing I wanted us to do this week was to think about the very origins of sin. And this week we need meetings for our bit further thoughts about that. So if you please come along to think about that. But I just want to end with this. In view of this parable, how might we respond if we met Frieda? A person who lives and thinks like the lost son. If I was to meet Frieda, what would I say to her? Now, I want you to assume that I've known Frieda for some time. There really is no danger of me and Frieda agreeing on anything much. Maybe what to have in the first course if we were eating dinner together. Beyond that, I cannot see myself agreeing with anything much with her. She knows that her views go against God and what God has commanded in the Bible. I'm not the only one that has explained that to her. This goes for her views on abortion, same-sex marriage, homosexual behaviour, gender identity, assisted suicide. And she knows that her lifestyle is similarly opposed to what the Bible commands. This does not concern her. It is the Bible that has the problem, not her, as far as Frieda is concerned. She knows all this and has not directly but indirectly called me bigoted on more than one occasion. And it really doesn't matter to her that she's going against the Bible and people like me. She's actually much more concerned about people like me, and that we still cling on to these outdated and repressive ideas and are actually holding society back from the way that society is meant to be evolving. You see, what's the message of the parable to Frieda? And that's another important question. How ready would I be to give this message? I would hope I would have the grace to tell it to her. But this is what the parable says to this godless woman. If a time was to come when you look at your life and your decisions and all that the world has to offer does not satisfy you, and you regret the decisions that you made and the things that you said, if you came to such a time and you realised that God does actually know best, God will not simply accept you. No. God will be looking out for you. He will set aside his dignity and run down the road to meet you. He will throw his arms around you and invite you to the best celebration that you've ever known. If God is ready and has lost his dignity for people like Frieda. People who have spat in his face, enjoying all that they can of God's wonderful world, whilst doing all they can to undermine God himself. Sin is not acting out of love for God, but the parable shows that God is ready to welcome everyone who will come. Frederick or Frieda, younger or older brother,